From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Hostilities between the U.S. and Russia are beginning to resemble the worst days of the Cold War, with a reported incident between a U.S. spy plane over Russia being pursued by Russian air defenses. U.S. officials confirmed reports that an American spy plane had invaded Sweden's airspace as it was evading a Russian fighter jet. The plane was spying on Russia when it was intercepted. The July 18th incident was first reported in Swedish media last Wednesday when a classified document from Sweden's defense ministry was leaked to the press. The plane entered Sweden's airspace after permission to do so was denied by traffic control. It passed from the east over the island of Gotland and flew more than 150 miles over Swedish territory before departing. The Russian fighter jet had been scrambled from a base in the Kaliningrad region in the pursuit of the American reconnaissance plane. A U.S. military source said the plane was conducting electronic eavesdropping on the Russian military when the latter locked onto the aircraft with a radar station and sent at least the one fighter jet to intercept it. The shortest escape route was through Swedish airspace, which the spy plane's pilot selected as the course despite Swedish objections. The source said that U.S. officials made known to Sweden that similar incidents may happen in the future. A CNN report didn't elaborate on Sweden's response. That country is not a member of NATO and maintains a non-aligned stance. Meanwhile, on the ground in eastern Ukraine, U.S.-backed Kiev military forces have killed several thousand civilians so far as they attempt to reverse the gains of the anti-government opposition. Patrick Lancaster is an American photo and video journalist who has spent the last 4 months in eastern Ukraine. We spoke with him this past Saturday about the causes behind the conflict, the sentiments of the average eastern Ukrainian residents, the combat situation on the ground, and details of the fighting around the Malaysian plane crash site, which he first inspected 4 hours after the crash and has visited numerous times over the past weeks since. We'll bring you part one of that interview later in this newscast. A spokesperson for senior UN relief workers reports that more than 250,000 Palestinians have been severely traumatized by the recent Israeli military operation against Gaza. Derek Mbatha reports from the United Nations.
Thousands of people displaced by the ongoing conflict in Gaza are deeply traumatized and live in fear, according to the spokesperson for the UN Relief Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. Chris Gunness told UN Radio on Monday that during what is called the seven-hour window announced by Israel in Gaza, the urgency is to resupply the shelters in which the displaced people have sought refuge. Mr. Gunness said that UNRWA is using the period of calm to get food and water, which he described as the absolute essentials of life, to as many of these shelters as possible.
There are nearly 270,000 displaced people in 90 UNRWA shelters across the Gaza Strip. These people are deeply traumatized and living in fear because we have seen that even a UN safe shelter, and I hate to use the word safe because it's such a misnomer, where thousands of people have taken refuge, even they are being hit. So there's nowhere that you can run in Gaza because there's a fence around it, and now there's nowhere safe in Gaza, and that's been shown beyond all doubt.
Chris Gunness said that the situation has become very difficult for the thousands of families who are now cramped in schools in Gaza. He pointed out that the displaced people also need sanitation and hygiene equipment, as well as mattresses, blankets, and basic needs for accommodation. Derek Mbatha, United Nations.
The total number of displaced Gazans is estimated at 475,000, the agency says, with the majority living in shelters that were UN-run schools before the outbreak of hostilities. Gunn has provided more details in an interview with journalist Patrick Maigwa.
There was to be a seven-hour humanitarian window today. Is it holding?
Well, from our point of view, the urgency is to resupply these 90 shelters. So for us, we are using the period of calm in which to get food and water, which are the absolute essentials of life, to as many of these shelters as possible. And of course, we also need sanitation equipment. We need hygiene equipment. And we also need mattresses and blankets and all the basic things of accommodation that people need. Don't forget, Patrick, that these are schools in ordinary times, schools for 1,000 students who come in the morning and leave in the afternoon. They are now crammed 24/7 with families, with people, and so the situation there is obviously very, very difficult.
With all these needs, has UNRWA got enough resources to cater for those who are displaced?
Well, we've launched an emergency appeal, a flash appeal, for nearly $200 million. For the moment, we are just about okay because donors have been very generous and have pledged well over $60 million, and we're very grateful to them. So money is not the initial problem, though money may become a problem, because we know from the experience of working in Gaza in the last two conflicts in the last 5 years that donor fatigue or the spotlight of the media moves on very quickly, and you know, we very soon find that our 15 minutes of fame is over. So for the moment, the appeal is okay. The more urgent problem, though, I think, is what's happening on the ground. It's about security. It's about the basics of life, such as food and water. It's about shelter and accommodation, mattresses, blankets. And then when this emergency phase is over and there is some kind of lasting peace, though I hate to use that word in this context, that's established, we're going to have to look at recovery and reconstruction, and we haven't even got there yet, but that's going to be a huge undertaking.
How would you describe the condition of the healthcare system? Is it coping?
There is a catastrophic health disaster unfolding in Gaza. People crammed together in close quarters, in overcrowded shelters, where there's poor sanitation, not necessarily enough clean water, and problems with food. That is a recipe for communicable diseases spreading very quickly, and that's what I fear we're on the verge of.
What about the health system? Is it able to cope with the large number of casualties? Are there enough medical supplies?
No, the hospitals are completely overrun. More than half of them are not even functioning because medics and health staff can't get to work because there's so much instability, violence, and insecurity. There had been a problem with electricity, so hospitals are spluttering along on unreliable emergency generators. Supplies of medicines had been severely depleted, and we estimate that 8,000 people have been wounded in the course of this war. Some of those are simply in the car park at Shifa Hospital, the main hospital in Gaza. So things are absolutely, as far as the health is concerned and as far as the general humanitarian situation is concerned, things are absolutely disastrous today in Gaza.
Meanwhile, UNRWA itself has been taking casualties since Israel began the attacks on Gaza. We have this report from Press TV.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says 9 of its staff members have been killed since the beginning of the conflict in Gaza on July the 8th. The UN body has said in a statement that for the third time in less than 6 years, violence is devastating the Gaza Strip, adding UNRWA staff, along with the people of Gaza, are in the line of fire. The director of UNRWA operations in Gaza has described the loss of staff as a tragedy that cannot be forgotten. Robert Turner said he couldn't understand why UN schools in Gaza continued to be hit, despite the Israeli military knowing that civilians are sheltering there.
We've called on, you know, consistently from the beginning, called on all parties to the conflict to respect the neutrality and inviolability of our installations, to use the proper precaution, distinction, and proportionality when dealing with military targets near our installations. As we've said before, the locations of all of these installations have been passed to the Israeli military multiple times. They know where these shelters are. How this continues to happen, I have no idea. I don't have words for it. I don't understand it.
And although the U.S. State Department added its voice to the global condemnation of Israeli attacks on UN relief workers and their facilities, Washington still has no plans to actually back up its words with actions. This was State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki Monday.
I want to get into your statement from yesterday on the UNRWA school. It was a pretty tough statement. I don't think anyone can deny that or would argue with that. I mean, you certainly wouldn't, would you? I mean, I can't recall there being this kind of, you know, harsh criticism of Israel coming from certainly this administration, but I can't remember going back many years. So you clearly felt very strongly about what happened here. And what I'm wondering is whether or not, in light of this statement and in light of the disgraceful shelling, as you called it, of this, if the administration is prepared to do anything to back up these strong words with some kind of an action, a demonstrable action against or towards Israel. In other words, you supply Israel with weapons and ammunition all the time. Is there any discussion about limiting that?
No.
In the latest reports before press time on Monday, the Israeli Air Force struck a refugee camp in Gaza City, killing an 8-year-old girl and wounding at least 29 others. The death toll from the world's worst Ebola outbreak had risen to 887 by Friday, while the total number of cases in the four West African countries affected stood at 1,603 on that same date. The recent figures mark a significant increase since last Thursday, when the published death toll was 158 people. Most of the deaths have been concentrated in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. On Monday, Nigeria reported that it has confirmed a second case of Ebola, indicating the disease is spreading there too. Two Americans have been infected in West Africa. One has already been transported to the U.S. for treatment. The other is expected to arrive early Tuesday. An Obama administration program secretly dispatched young Latin Americans to Cuba using the cover of health and civic programs to provoke political change. Beginning as early as October 2009, a project overseen by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, sent Venezuelan, Costa Rican, and Peruvian young people to Cuba in hopes of stirring up rebellion. The travelers worked undercover, often posing as tourists, and traveled around the island, scouting for people they could turn into political activists. In one case, the workers formed an HIV prevention workshop that memos called the perfect excuse for the program's political goals, a move that could undermine confidence in American efforts to address various health crises globally. An Associated Press investigation found USAID and its contractor, Creative Associates International, continued the program even as U.S. officials privately told their government contractors to consider suspending travel to Cuba after the arrest of contractor Alan Gross, who remains imprisoned after being accused of smuggling in sensitive technology. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki was questioned about the program at her daily press conference Monday.
Why shouldn't the Cuban government, which has accused you of trying to, accused you of promoting regime change activity on the island, why shouldn't they see this as that, as such an effort?
Well, I think the USAID, as many people know, including governments around the world, have a long-standing history of supporting democracy and human rights. There are places, some of these programs, including programs in Cuba, are operated in a discreet manner to help ensure the safety of those involved. This was a program that made information available. It was engaged with local issues independent of the Cuban government.
Right, so that was you understand, the given the U.S. history in Latin America, particularly with in terms of regime change in the past, why shouldn't the Cubans be suspicious? Why shouldn't they think that this is something that is aimed at not simply educating their people, but in fact changing and overthrowing their government?
Because I think the facts about what the program were focused on are inconsistent with that view.
Don't programs such as this actually endanger the work of people who are engaged in health and education and other humanitarian work under the USAID flag?
Well, again, Roz, I think there are a range of programs that USAID oversees. Again, these programs are Congress is fully briefed on these programs, and they promote a range of information sharing in countries around the world. And this was obviously a program, and this contract was one that was approved through that process.
But doesn't anyone in the U.S. government understand that this is undermining the very credibility that is needed in order for these programs, which are run directly by USAID and through other contractors, namely NGOs, who are counting on the goodwill extended toward the U.S. government in order to do their work effectively?
Well, I think you're jumping a bit to a conclusion there, Roz. I think there are programs around the world that are oriented towards developing a more vibrant and capable civil society, consistent with democracy promotion programs worldwide. And obviously, this contract was in line with that.
But I have heard from others who do this kind of work who say that when USAID deviates into an area that is better suited for another agency, and we'll just leave it unmentioned here, that it makes it more dangerous for their employees to carry out the work that they are trying to do. Wouldn't it be simpler to put up a firewall?
Let me just stop you there for a second, because I would hardly compare this to the work of other agencies. This was not a covert program. There are programs that are done discreetly in order to protect the safety of the people involved.
But the mission of the program undercuts the work which NGOs tell me that they are trying to conduct, because the first thing that people will ask them is, how do we know that you're not CIA?
Well, strengthening a civil society, in empowering a civil society to be more capable is something that was the focus of this program, and that's, again, I think what's being communicated with any who have concerns.
Is the Secretary comfortable with this apparent mixing of missions?
We would disagree with that characterization.
The revelations of the program come as the White House faced questions about the once secret Cuban Twitter project known as Zunzunio. That program, launched by USAID in 2009, and uncovered by the Associated Press in April, established a primitive social media network under the noses of Cuban officials. USAID's Inspector General is investigating that program, which ended in September 2012. Officials said USAID launched discrete programs like Zunzunio to increase the flow of information in the country, but the Associated Press's earlier investigation found Zunzunio was political in nature and drew in subscribers who were unaware that the service was paid for by the U.S. government. With reports about the crisis at the border involving thousands of immigrants percolating through the press, the fact that record numbers of legal immigrants are being locked up is seldom discussed. Even less frequent is media coverage looking at the factors which could be driving this relatively new and quite substantial change in policy involving tens of thousands of legal immigrants. RT's Marina Portnaya reports.
The country that once opened its doors to immigrants is becoming better known as the land that jails them.
The Congress, for the past several years, has set a mandatory requirement on the federal government to maintain 34,000 detention beds for immigration detention purposes only.
It's otherwise known as detention bed quota, exclusive to America's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. With a minimum of 34,000 beds, the quota serves as incentive to keep the jails filled at full occupancy.
It's definitely about money, about profits.
Nasri Mustaqim served 313 days in an immigrant detention facility, unable to post bail or receive a bond hearing.
Since I went through it and had personal experience and seeing who was detained and how it affected the guys in there, a lot of them just had expired visa or something. They are not criminals.
Nas immigrated to the country legally at 13, and his wife is a U.S. citizen. He was arrested at his home in 2011 in connection with a four-year-old guilty plea for drug possession.
We never had any encounters with immigration beforehand. Nas's green card was renewed every 10 years, and that was the extent of it.
The U.S.'s Immigrant and Customs Enforcement Agency has a budget of nearly $2 billion, a budget footed by American taxpayers. In 2012, the agency detained nearly 478,000 immigrants, many of whom are housed in private, corporate-owned detention centers subcontracted by the U.S. government.
It make me sick because this bed quota made me stay in there, held me there for a high amount of money. It's like $160 a night. And at the same time, you know, I can't be working to support my family just so that this company can make money out of me being detained.
And locking up immigrants is hardly the only option available to the U.S. government.
Congress, or at least many members who are pushing this agenda, don't trust the president to enforce immigration laws. And they think that by requiring these people to be detained, that it's going to urge the president to actually effectuate their eventual removal from the country. There are other methods, such as alternatives to detention, use of intensive supervision, custody checks on the person, telephonic monitoring.
But the cost-effective options wouldn't necessarily benefit the corporations behind America's detention and deportation machine.
You realize early on when you start reading just a few articles that, oh, there's something called Geo Group and CCA, and they make billions of dollars off of this. And then you start seeing how it aligns, how it parallels with like the lack of adequate medical care and the food quality, and why they don't even allow contact visits because it's cheaper for them to allow you to visit only through a glass, and just those kind of things start making sense.
A reality in which a bed quota puts a price tag on the lives of tens of thousands of immigrants. Marina Portnaya, RT, New York.
Patrick Lancaster is an American journalist who has spent the last 4 months in eastern Ukraine. He spoke with us this past Saturday about the situation there, live from Donetsk. We now bring you part one of that interview. Let's start at the beginning. You know, there's been sort of a running narrative about what's happening in Ukraine, woven in and out of the headlines, depending on what else is going on, with some big gaps. And a serious bias to the narrative, of course, that begins and ends more or less with, we don't know what it is, but it's Putin's fault. The country is at civil war now. I think that's a fair assessment of the situation. You're on the ground, of course, and so if you disagree, please chime in on that. But assuming that, could you point to the genesis of this civil war, and the, you know, over the not going back 100 years, but over the past year or so, and maybe bring us forward, like what's happened and how did we get where we are?
Well, I think some of the unrest in Donetsk really stemmed from after the replacements in the government in Kiev. One of the first things they went forward with was trying to make the Russian language not an official language anymore. And I think that really upset a lot of people. And of course, there was many different things that added to it, but it was kind of not the starting point, but something that got a lot of the people upset.
Why exactly did that upset people? I mean, I know symbolically it sounds, you know, like an offensive thing, you know, gee, they're picking on us or whatever. But what was the actual sort of gut response of people there based on? What was their thinking? Were they afraid? Were they upset? Was there, you know, what were they, why such a response?
Well, the vast majority of the people in this part of the country are ethnic Russians, and they speak Russian here. There's no people that really speak the Ukrainian language in this part of the country, and by Kiev making the Ukrainian language the only official language of the country, it just made people seem like they weren't really as part of the country as the western part of the country.
All right, so it starts with this legislation after the coup, and that removes a law that had been installed a few years back that, you know, made Russian an official language. And then, you know, it's quite a long walk, though, from there to more or less open civil war. Maybe you could take us through, you know, some of the events on the touchstones from then to now.
Well, during April, I came from Crimea to Donetsk when I heard of the problem starting here. And my first day on the ground here in Donetsk, I visited the local administration building where they declared the Donetsk People's Republic. It was in the news quite a bit. I think most people are maybe familiar with the images of it.
Right.
But at that point, it was just
basically that building in the city that had been under control of protesters. And there were no firearms visible at this point, just bats and sticks and clubs and things like this. You know, nothing super paramilitary. But on that same day, there was a meeting or a protest, and it happened to walk through Lenin Square, and more people started joining, and I think it got to the point where it was close to about 5,000 or so, and they walked straight to the local Donbass police station, and started wasn't violent or anything at this point. It was just they were communicating with the police officers inside, from what was translated to me, how they were, you know, upset with the way the police department had been treating people, especially the members of the police department that were pro-Kiev. And then the protesters called the Berkut, which is a part of the paramilitary police service of Ukraine. And they came, and some people expected that they were going to try to, you know, kind of calm the people down. But at this point, they were like, you know, we're not going to fight the people. We're not going to stop you from doing this. You know, if you go ahead, you know, you go ahead. We refuse to fight the people, so we're leaving, is basically what they said. They left, and then there was a few holes hitting on some glass of the police station, and then the doors came open, and riot police came out in full gear, and more. There was hours and hours of talking, but they eventually communicated that the police officers were going to let the protesters have the building.
Right.
And I was right there at the front, and when it was kind of like they were given permission to come in, but also kind of pushed in. It was a very kind of complicated situation. But once the first few people of the protesters came in, they put the little ribbons on all the riot police, the ribbons that signify the independence of Donetsk People's Republic, and let them all march out with these ribbons on them. And then a large part of the protesters went inside and just took control of the building. And little things like that would happen around the city for the next couple of months.
This started when? This was April, was this?
Yeah, this was April. Okay. And from that point forward, you know, every week or every 2 weeks, you'd hear about a new building that was taken. And then, but they were all taken fairly peacefully. I mean, with there was some violence, but, you know, no major,
like,
you know,
jostling, like
military strikes or anything take these buildings, just, you know, people going in. But then I can't remember offhand the dates, but the day that the in Odessa, where so many people got burned alive inside the trade union building, that really kind of set off an interesting, well, I don't know how to put it exactly. It really set off a chain reaction of hostilities in response to those people losing their lives in such a horrible way. And that night, I went to the administration building, and there was a sort of funeral type memorial service going on where people were lighting candles for the dead of Odessa. But then I noticed at the same time there were car after car coming in, and people were going to the cars and unloading bags and boxes of ammunition and guns, just hundreds and maybe even thousands of weapons at that point. So I think, and then in the days after that and weeks after is when it really, in as far as Donetsk goes, really stepped up as far as the people being armed here. That's when it really turned into an armed control of the government.
And we'll bring you more of that interview with Patrick Lancaster, an American journalist in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine, tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.